Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, June 9th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, how about that Knicks game last night?
Oh, I know. Oof.
Go Spurs. I'm sorry. I'm going to hit the cough button there. A lot of celebrities attended Madison Square Garden, including the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I doubt he had to pay for his own ticket, but if he had to, he certainly could have afforded it, because according to some estimates, the president has made between $2 and $4 billion
Cha-ching.
In just the course of his second term. How's he done it? Well, there are many who believe he has done it through a series of transactions and self-dealing mechanisms that come at the expense of taxpayers and the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go through some of those allegations today. They're very detailed. They're very complicated. But luckily, we have an investigative reporter from the New York Times, Eric Lipton, who, by the way, is a Philly area native, who has been covering this extensively for years before the second term began. And probably knows more about this than any other journalist in the world. There are examples that span the globe, that span industries. Again, they're very complicated, but we thought it was worth taking the time to go through them in one big episode. We'll also have a presidential historian on hand, Douglas Brinkley, who can tell us how this compares to past presidents and administrations. We do have a couple questions for you as well. What do you think about the wealth President Trump has accumulated in his second term? Do you have questions about Trump's business dealings? Like I said, some complicated stuff there. You might just have questions. So give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. If you have questions about the Knicks and Spurs, we cannot answer those today.
Yes. No, we cannot. We know we cannot. It's so interesting. People were not happy with the president being there. Caused a lot of congestion.
Yeah.
And delays and all sorts of things. But we're not talking about that, as Avi said. I look forward to hearing what you think about the wealth President Trump has accumulated in his second term and any questions you have. Again, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We have our trio of news stories, and we're going to start in Bucks County.
Take us there.
Bucks County officials announced this week that they are now suing Roblox, Discord, Meta, and X as part of a lawsuit against social media companies over harms against young people. The lawsuit alleges that these companies use unfair, deceptive, and misleading business practices that keep kids engaged on those platforms. And lawyers for the county, they accuse Roblox, for example, of having lax parental controls, no age verification, and of creating addictive games that make it easy for predators to access kids online. And this announcement comes just after a 32-year-old Bucks County man was sentenced for posing as a teen on Roblox so that he could exploit a 13-year-old girl from Tennessee and a 16-year-old from North Carolina. That's according to our news partner, 6ABC. And now this latest suit is an expansion of the original 2023 lawsuit that the Bucks County DA office filed back in against TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, and Snapchat. The Bucks County DA, Joe Kahn, says that the companies have gotten worse in the 3 years since that lawsuit was filed. And I have to say, Bucks County has been leading the nation and taking on these social media companies for causing harm and trying to get reimbursed for all the services that they have to provide young people. And this county is also the first to specifically sue X, alleging that the platform lacks sufficient child safety precautions. So Bucks County leading the charge, taking on not just social media companies, but also gaming companies now.
Yeah, and it seems like there's two buckets of accusations here.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the algorithms are addictive.
Yep.
And they feed into negative emotional responses for young people. The other is that they just lack proper protocols to keep children away from people who would do children harm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if one of those legal arguments will have more power in the long run or will force more change. And that could dictate the types of changes, if these lawsuits are successful, that the companies have to make. Because to me, it might be downstream from which of these arguments ends up having more legal weight.
Yeah, and I think what the DA's office thought was going to happen is that they would file this lawsuit and that they would see some shift in the companies just by the threat that these lawsuits were happening, and they've been happening all over the country. But according to reporting, the DA says, no, you guys have not made any changes or enough changes. And so we've got to throw everything at it, basically, to try to force change here, and we'll see what happens.
Change, loose change. That goes to our next story.
Good one.
The Philly-based discount retailer Five Below is reporting strong sales this year, perhaps because inflation-weary consumers are looking for low-priced alternatives. They have got that. Mm-hmm. They've also got a new store strategy that's apparently paying dividends. So about 20% of the merchandise at Five Below is actually above $5, despite the store's name. Mm-hmm. Now, those items used to be in a separate section called Five Beyond. Mm-hmm. According to the Inquirer, Five Below's CEO said on a recent earnings call that the Five Beyond section is now eliminated, and those pricier products are interspersed throughout the store, meaning if you walk into a Five Below and pick something off the shelf, there's a 1 in 5 chance that it's more than $5. Do you follow?
Yes, I do. And it feels a bit sneaky to me. Because I've shopped at Five Below, as I'm sure many of you have, and you go in there, you're like 5, 10, 15, 20, thinking you're going to spend $20 on 4 items. But then if you just throw things in there willy-nilly without actually looking at the price, you could get to the register and realize one item was 5, another was 10, another was 15, and another was 20.
Yeah.
And so you may think you're spending $20, but you get a bill for 60.
Yeah.
So to me,
so
I don't
pay
know.
Attention at the cash register.
You got to pay attention now. You can't just go in there, because people go in Five Below and they end up with a cart full of stuff.
Yeah, they really box themselves in with that brand name.
Yeah,
and it's a good brand name. But
inflation is real.
Exactly. At some point in time, this
tariffs,
is going to become
real.
An issue. Like this is going to be an issue. If you call yourself Five Below, and that makes a lot of sense. I think early 2000s is when they started. But at some point, someday. And you can't change your name. You're already Five Below.
Because that's what everybody knows you for.
Yeah.
And so
got the logo and everything.
And you get less and less things that are actually below $5.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I assume Dollar General and Dollar Tree, they have the same issue.
Yeah, they don't. It's very few things that are actually $1.
Well, like, what can you possibly buy for $1 anymore?
I know.
You can get like one chiclet for
$1.
You're right, though.
But it was nice when you could go there and it would be sort of, you knew. Everything over here.
Remember the days where you could go to a concert for $1? Transition story number 3.
Oh, yeah. A Fishtown couple, they have accomplished their lifelong dream of transforming their row home garage into a really funky retro style music venue. I absolutely love this story in Philly Voice about Morgan Walbridge and Joe Lockwood. They are owners of Nostalgia Fishtown. It's an event space, lounge space, music rehearsal, and music venue complete with a Nostalgia brand and vintage t-shirt thrift shop.
Okay. Ooh, baby.
Really cool. And let me tell you about them. Walbridge and Lockwood, they met as student musicians at University of the Arts in 2016. They were inspired by the culture there, where working musicians just came together and jammed, right? And had collab sessions. They
love
absolutely
a good jam.
Loved it. They spent years searching for a perfect space to bring people together. They found this cool row home on Jefferson Street where they could live upstairs and have that music venue downstairs. And then boom, U of Arts abruptly closed. And to bring people together, because everybody was traumatized, Avi, they started having these low-key events. Mm. And the line started getting long outside.
Low-key became high-key.
Yeah, and Elle and I shut them down.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, so they spent the past couple of years getting their paperwork in order, getting everything up to code, and they'll be opening officially at the end of the month. And it looks so cool. They literally have been collecting items from over years. I mean, Lockwood brought in the throw rug from the dining room of his childhood home, and it's in there. They have a wall covered with vinyl record covers. It's a really cool space.
Yeah, and they live right upstairs.
I know.
That's great. I always actually had a dream that maybe I would have a business and live upstairs from the business.
That's a cool dream. I could see myself doing something like that, too. This is an awesome
Now,
idea.
I wouldn't have a music venue because
no.
I don't know anything about that. I would probably have a business where whatever we're making smells good.
Ooh, you like food.
Yeah. So like, how about churros? I have a churro business.
In the basement and in the first floor.
My wife had this idea to start a churro business because, well, I don't know how to make churros, but
That actually, like, the cinnamon, because you love cinnamon smells. You would talk about Cinnabon being in
Metro. And also just like, there are some places, like I was in Spain and you could just eat, there's so many churros available. People are always selling churros and it's a great snack. And I feel like they're kind of hard to find here in Philly. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, I do. Every time there's a couple taco places that I get delivery from and they sell churros and we always get them.
No, but we would specialize in churros.
You'll be a churro place.
Churro only. Churros in the first floor. I'm living upstairs with the smells.
And that's a beautiful dream.
Thank you.
You know what? I hope it comes true for you.
This is my last episode of Studio 2. I have some investors lined up. Speaking of investors, President Trump, his investments are raising eyebrows in his second term. We're going to tell you more about them on the other side of this break. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Watchdog groups and ethics experts are sounding the alarm about how President Trump is using his office for personal profit. They allege the levels of corruption and self-dealing from Mr. Trump and his family have never been seen before. Some estimates put his personal profits close to $4 billion just in his second term.
Among the examples they give, record numbers of stock trades, family ventures in cryptocurrency and prediction markets, and Pentagon contracts for family businesses. People also charge that the White House operates a pay-to-play culture, rewarding supporters and donors with friendly policy decisions and even pardons.
Yes, New York Times reporter Eric Lipton has been investigating Trump business dealings for over a decade. He joins us today to walk us through some of the conflicts of interest that they raise. And later this hour, we'll talk with historian Douglas Brinkley and ask him about what past presidents have done. Eric, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What do you think about the wealth President Trump has accumulated in his second term? Do you have questions about Trump's business dealings? This is the time to ask them. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, leave a comment in the live chat.
Yeah, and Eric, we wanted to start with the differences kind of between President Trump's first term and second term, because when President Trump entered his second term, he did not adopt some of the voluntary restrictions that previous presidents embraced to avoid the appearance of conflict of interest. And so I know you've been covering the president for quite some time. What made you realize that Trump's second term wasn't simply a continuation of the first?
I mean, the first term already was quite unusual, and the president in his first term continued to profit from his family businesses, even though legally speaking, he had put them into a trust and the trust was being run by his sons. But for example, with the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., where the Saudi government rented out, you know, a bunch of rooms right after he was elected, at Mar-a-Lago in Florida and in various hotels and golf courses and resorts, they were taking in revenue in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, cumulatively perhaps in the millions. So that was already very unusual, almost unlike any other modern president in U.S. history. But the second term is just radically different. It's on a scale that has no precedent. And we're talking now of billions of dollars in revenues that have been generated by business operations that are profiting the revenues that are going to the President Trump through cryptocurrency and through to his sons through everything from the Defense Department to, you know, metals and all kinds of predictions markets, and even his use of Truth Social, which is a social media platform. All of his announcements are on Truth Social, and that is a company that, you know, that he owns and profits from and is the biggest shareholder. So this is just radically different than anything in American history. It's a scale of profiteering that I don't think anyone ever anticipated a president would be involved in. There are really no laws to explicitly prohibit it. It's not a criminal conflict of interest what he's doing. It just is a norm that no president ever considered violating.
One sort of type of defense you hear of this is that, look, Trump and his family are business people. They have business interests all over the world in all sorts of industries. That these types of conflicts or perceived conflicts are basically inevitable just because they're doing business out in the world. Obviously, there have been other presidents whose families are enmeshed in the business world. I am curious what you make of that as a sort of category of defense.
I mean, that was more of a realistic argument in the first term. And I mean, and that is an argument that we continue to hear from the White House and from, you know, Eric and Don Jr. Don Jr. has made that point to me personally, you know, that I've been a businessman for many years. But for example, in the first term, they didn't do any new international deals and with like foreign governments or any new international deals at all with India or the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, which they've been done a bunch of deals more recently when he was reelected. But they stopped the new deals, and their business operations were largely static in the first term. And so, you know, while Trump was driving revenues to, you know, the Trump Durrell or the hotel in D.C. or Mar-a-Lago by, you know, saying, oh, we should meet there or, you know, gather there, it was still they weren't opening new businesses to take advantage of regulatory changes that he was making. And so that's the thing that has caused the most discomfort is when, for example, Trump announces that he's going to be the crypto president and going to deregulate the cryptocurrency industry. He's going to appoint a head of the Securities and Exchange Commission who was a former crypto industry lawyer, and then they're going to drop most of the enforcement actions against the crypto companies that were initiated during the Biden administration at the same time as he himself is revenue benefiting from revenue from one of the largest crypto stablecoin issuers in the world. That's just the level of conflict that is completely different from what happened in the first term. And that argument doesn't really work there because they entered the cryptocurrency industry just in 2025 for the first time. They were moving in that direction just as he was running for re-election. So that doesn't hold up.
And so, Eric, before we start going through some of the big buckets of conflicts, of potential conflicts that we're seeing this administration engage in and the Trump family, I want to talk about just, you know, level set with what a conflict of interest is and then just sort of how out in the open this is, because you started our conversation by talking about how there is no law that specifically makes what the Trump administration and what the Trump family and those connected with Mr. Trump, what they're doing illegal. Can you just sort of talk about what the norms typically have been so that people can really understand and then give voice to how open and pervasive these new norms have become?
There's a federal conflict of interest statute. It's a criminal law for a federal employee to take an action that benefits him or herself or his or her immediate family. So it's illegal to participate in a particular matter that benefits, you know, yourself, your own portfolio, or the portfolio of your spouse or your immediate family members. But the president and the vice president are exempt from that criminal statute, and they're the only executive branch employees who are exempt. And the argument is that the president is involved in everything and in all policy in some way or another. So you can't technically, I guess, you know, the Congress, it's another thing is that Congress can't pass a law because of the separation of powers between the different branches. They can't pass a law that puts a criminal statute above the president. And then similarly, the Supreme Court has ruled that when the president takes an official action, recently the Supreme Court ruled this, that he's protected he's protected from prosecution if his action is a part of an official duty. Now there is the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which prohibits the president or any other federal official from taking a gift, you know, something of value from a foreign entity. And that was something that advocates and members of Congress, nonprofit groups, even some restaurants in D.C. sued in federal court during his first term to argue that he was violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Those lawsuits went, you know, actually ultimately reached one of them, the Supreme Court. But it was because of the Trump people are so effective at running out the clock. It didn't get to the Supreme Court until Trump had just left office, and the Supreme Court then ruled it to be moot. And that law doesn't really have a penalty. It's not a criminal statute. There's no real penalty, even if you were to establish it. No one has filed an emoluments lawsuit in the second term I think they just felt like they, you know, that it
was a
doesn't
waste of
really
time.
have much impact to do it,
Yeah.
so they didn't do it. So that is there is a part of the Constitution that says he shouldn't be taking gifts from foreign governments of value, and but that's not a criminal statute.
So there's no real rules, and there was only customs. Yeah.
Yeah. Mr.
Yeah, I mean,
Harrell,
it's just,
go ahead.
it's been the norm that presidents, you know, particularly dating back to the Nixon administration, but really, you know, in modern history, that there has been an effort by Democrats and Republicans to put things into what blind trust they're called, in which they don't even have visibility into investments that are being made on their behalf, or sell off individual holdings and put it into mutual funds, or just invest in treasury funds, sell any individual holdings in companies. I mean, you know, from President Bush, who sold, you know, an ownership stake in a professional baseball team, Jimmy Carter, who put his, you know, famously his peanut farm in supposedly into a blind trust. I mean, there's just been something that Democrat and Republican presidents, Obama, you know, the Bush, both of the Bushes have done.
Yeah.
But, you know, President Trump has decided, he says, he argues, well, these are in a trust that's run by my sons. But he is still the beneficial, you know,
yeah,
he's still the
yeah.
beneficial owner of that trust.
Right.
He still benefits from it. So it really, there's the Constitution and the laws of the United States were not created for a president like President Trump. And it's up to Congress and the public to decide if they want to change those laws or accept this approach.
Yep. Let me read in some comments. By the way, we're asking you this hour, what do you think about the wealth President Trump has accumulated in his second term? Do you have questions about Trump's business dealings? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can comment in the live chat. Speaking of past presidents, Mr. Harold Williams on YouTube says, if Obama did anything like Trump's doing, they would have him locked under the jail. Susan from Schwanksville says, I'm a 75-year-old registered Republican, and he, Trump, is just a crook. Brian says, Trump only cares about Trump. He has used and will continue to use his power, position to amass power and money, usually at taxpayers' expense. Look, there are a lot of potential examples we could go through, Eric. I wanted to go through one that I think touches on a few of the different ways that Trump and his family may be benefiting from the administration and driving policy decisions. So let's talk about World Liberty Financial. And you just stop me if I've ever made an error setting this up. This is the Trump family's cryptocurrency company. They're involved. They share ownership with others, including members of the Witkoff family. People might know the name Steve Witkoff. He's a foreign envoy that represents the Trump administration in various foreign negotiations. So let's first talk about World Liberty Financial. What is it and when did it come into existence?
It was created in the fall of 2025. Donald Trump, the president, was a co-founder. His sons, both of his sons were also participated in it. So did Witkoff's son. So it was created just before the election, and it was born with basically no assets. And now it took $2 billion in money that was put into it by the government of the United Arab Emirates. That happened in May of 2025 after Trump was in office. And while the United Arab Emirates was seeking access to advanced artificial intelligence chips from the president. And so in the same month that they moved $2 billion, one of the largest single transaction involving stablecoins in the history of the industry, into a firm that he directly profits from. At the same time as they did that, they were seeking permission from President Trump to purchase some of NVIDIA's most advanced AI chips. There were people in the security office, you know, the National Security Office and in the State Department who were quite concerned about this and concerned that UAE might share some of this technology with China, because the UAE is kind of has both friends in both China and in the West. And so there were some that were opposed to this, but, you know, that created a massive apparent conflict of interest.
So just to review that for folks as they try to follow along. So they set up this company, World Liberty Financial. It's a cryptocurrency company. They get a huge investment from a firm that is tied to the UAE, the Emirati government.
It's owned by the UAE government.
Owned by the Emiratis. Okay. And at around the same time, the U.S. gives the green light to export some microchips to the UAE. And the reason we hadn't done that before is because we were worried, the U.S. government was worried, that China could get access to that technology, and it was a national security, if not threat, at least a risk. So
yeah, I mean, the United States had previously agreed to allow companies like Microsoft to have operations in Abu Dhabi, part of UAE, in which they had some of these NVIDIA chips, but they had not previously agreed to allow a company called G42, owned by Abu Dhabi, to control the chips directly themselves previously. Yep. And that was a national security concern. And for the first time, while in May of 2025, the same month that those $2 billion in stable coins were purchased by G42's sister company, Trump went to Abu Dhabi and signed an agreement to agree to share those advanced chips.
Now, just to establish this now, who benefits financially from the growth of World Liberty Financial? Just, I guess, yes or no here. The president himself, yes.
Yes.
Steve Witkoff, the foreign envoy, yes?
His family does, yes.
His family does.
He asserts that he has now divested his stake in World Liberty, although he still held it at the time of that event. And he was involved in the deliberations with the UAE. He was there when the deal was signed, and he participated in some of the meetings where it was discussed. So he and his sons are both, his family is benefiting significantly. Those $2 billion are generating interest, and they are profiting from that interest. Yeah.
And just to stay on this for one more beat, so this is an example of potentially a foreign policy decision being tied up in a transfer of wealth that benefits the president and some of the president's inner circle. There's also this separate concern with the Trump administration that they dole out favors and pardons in exchange for financial benefit. And there is a man named, I hope I'm getting his name right, Xiangpeng Zhao, who Trump pardoned. He's the founder of a company called Binance. When did the Trump administration pardon this man, and how are they connected to World Liberty Financial?
So CZ, everyone calls him, is a brilliant guy, is creator of the Binance, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, massively wealthy, actually now lives out of United Arab Emirates and is closely tied with the United Arab Emirates. And he was pled guilty and was served time in jail for violating American crypto securities laws by allowing people to trade on his platform who were U.S. citizens, even though that trading was prohibited. And his company was charged and he was charged. And now Binance, that $2 billion that went into World Liberty was going through World Liberty on its way to Binance. CZ and World Liberty are closely tied, and Binance are closely tied, this is getting complicated. But after that, $2 billion went from United Arab Emirates to World Liberty. That was basically an investment that United Arab Emirates was making in World Liberty. I'm sorry, in Binance and in CZ's company, and he has left it in World Liberty since May of 2025. So again, the way you make money as a stablecoin issuer is you invest that $2 billion into treasuries to back it up, and then you take the yield. That yield is your profit as the stablecoin issuer. And CZ has left that $2 billion with World Liberty, and that's the largest share of their stablecoin balance. And so basically, Binance and CZ are basically paying money to the Witkoff and Trump's families by leaving that $2 billion there instead of pulling it out and using it for their own business operations. So while CZ was enriching the Trump family, he was seeking a pardon from President Trump, and he got that pardon. And now he no longer has a criminal record, and he's able to start to rebuild his business operations in the United States.
Okay.
So that, again, it's like nothing like that had ever happened before in American history, where you have the president's family directly financially benefiting from something, and then the president using his extreme powers of a pardon to pardon that person who is bringing them enormous financial benefit.
Who had helped.
It's just, we have, like, there were cases with, you know, President Clinton, with Mark Rich, and people who had relationships, but there's never been a direct financial connection worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. And that person getting a pardon.
So we're going to come back on the other side of this break, because you brought up Clinton. We're going to talk to a presidential historian and try to do some compare and contrast here. And there are other financial conflicts of financial conflicts of interest that we could get into later in the show as well. I just wanted to spend time on one as a clarifying example. We're talking with Eric Lipton. We're hearing from you. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back, listeners, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about President Trump's business dealings and the mounting allegations that he is using the presidency for personal profit. New York Times investigative journalist Eric Lipton has been walking us through his family's ventures and the ethical questions they raise. Now we want to turn to presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, a professor at Rice University, to get a sense of how this compares to past administrations. Douglas, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the wealth President Trump has accumulated in his second term? Do you have questions about Trump's business dealings? 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook. Leave a comment in the live chat.
And so, Douglas, I mean, historians are rarely careful with the word unprecedented. But I have to ask you, I mean, you probably heard a lot of what Eric was talking about. But is this really unprecedented, what we're seeing now? Are there any historical comparisons?
No, there's no other U.S. president that tried to use the White House as a platform to get rich. By nature, they make a good salary, $400,000 a year, and have Secret Service protection for life and good pensions. But most of them are very humbly want to, you know, disassociate from the profiteering of being president and wait till they're out of office. Out of office, they do make money. They give speeches like Ronald Reagan did for $1 million in Japan after he left office. And they sign big book contracts, memoirs for, you know, $10 million or more even in some cases, but not to do what Donald Trump's doing. Trump's using the White House as part of Trump business interest. And you can see it with his crypto platforms. You can see what he's doing with his global branding deals. You can see it with what he's trying to do with Saudi Arabia. It's a nonstop, in my mind, kind of presidential grift. Just by promoting the name Trump, make as much money as he can, and then get out of office and be not just a billionaire, but a multi-billionaire. There's no end to what Donald Trump wants to do, and that when it comes to becoming one of the richer people in the United States, he looks up to the billionaires, the Elon Musk types, yeah. Not people that are about good governance or following constitutional law or institution building, like most presidents are.
Yeah. And I scoured, recent presidential history looking for any type of financial scandal tied to a president. And the only thing I could come up with was the Whitewater scandal that came up during the Clinton administration. And there was real estate dealings there. There had been a lengthy independent counsel investigation that targeted real estate investments made by Bill and Hillary Clinton. That was an issue that did come up. But you say that this is still what you're seeing with President Donald Trump versus the Clintons at that time. Can you make a comparison and why that is very, very tiny or insignificant when you compare to what is happening right now?
Well, Bill and Hillary Clinton were cleared on Whitewater charges. It was a deep investigation. You know, people don't realize Bill and Hillary had no home. When they hit the White House, they didn't even own a condominium in Arkansas. He had been in the governor's mansion for so long, and they didn't have any place that was their own. The right opposition going after him looked at Whitewater deep and hard, trying to make a connection that they're trying to buy a lakefront property in Arkansas. And all of a sudden, it went nowhere. It did unravel some other parts of Bill Clinton's extramarital affairs and the like, but it really meant nothing. We're talking deep, deep with Donald Trump. I mean, he's going everywhere, almost threatening world leaders. You don't want to do business with me. You don't want to help me enrich myself and be part of the Trump empire. Then I will punish you. I'll have nothing to do with you. We saw it with the way he threw tariffs on countries of people that weren't kissing the ring of Donald Trump. So We use, what Trump is, we've seen it in American history with P.T. Barnum's or Al Capone, both people Donald Trump admires. We see it, in a mob-like setting, but there's no sacredness to what Donald Trump is doing. He's not looking at the White House and seeing it as something, my gosh, I've inherited this incredible place that belongs to the American people. He's seeing every day, how can I brand anything in Washington? Brand anything with my name. And hence we're having these issues of the way he demolished the East Wing of the White House. And he's trying to put his arc of triumph to himself in DC. And he's going to do the National Mall with Blue Waters. And it's all just this sort of all a part and parcel of somebody who's only cares about sees the White House as a stepping stone to becoming a mega billionaire, even though he's a billionaire already.
Let me bring in a caller who has a question about the Constitution. I believe this is Howard in New Jersey. Howard, you're on Studio 2. Do you have a question for our experts?
Yeah, my question was whether it actually would require a constitutional change to rein in any future presidential abuses of power.
So, Douglas, let me ask you that. What did the look, we're going back here, but did the founders anticipate this potential problem? What did they think about it as they were putting the Constitution together? And in your mind, I know we're not, none of us around the table here are like sort of focusing on the legal aspect of it, but would this require a constitutional change, just a regular federal statute? Your thoughts on that?
I think it needs a constitutional change, and we're in the time of executive power, kind of federalist society world. If you go back to George Washington, and it's not in our Constitution that much of what a president has become, meaning there's no line about what is executive orders. Washington did one for neutrality, but all the presidents from Washington to Lincoln, they did two executive orders for. It was a big deal that Andrew Jackson did 12 executive orders. But Lincoln added new foundational documents to our country, the first inaugural and second Gettysburg Address, but particularly the Emancipation Proclamation, which then kicked in with the 14th Amendment, doing away with slavery. And by the 20th century, starting with Theodore Roosevelt, what was a big deal of 12 executive orders, TR did over 1,000, and then FDR did over 3,000. And the problems with executive orders, and Trump's in that mode right now, is it's a way to garner headlines every day. Second term, Trump's first EO was on inaugural day, where he released all of the insurrectionists of January 6th. And he's signing them every day in massive ceremonies. Well, a lot of these are just bunk. Some affect Americans greatly. The courts throw things out left and right that Trump's doing, but it takes a year or nearly a year. And so the legal system is slow. So what we were talking about President Trump swamping the system. He's using executive orders, not just to get his own agenda through, but to minimize the need for legislative oversight. Hence, we're in a war in Iran. And we were not going to Congress and getting the 1973 war approval. We're just ignoring all of this because fundamentally Donald Trump has said, I'm just telling you, the way he thinks, he believes when Richard Nixon's line, if the president does it, it must be legal. And if you take that, he's doing that now. Whatever he's doing is legal. If he wants to get an airplane from the Saudis and a yacht from Kuwait and influence peddle with cryptocurrency or affect how world markets come and fall and rise, he feels it's my prerogative. I'm president. He even, the White House just days ago said, people are complaining about the East Wing of the White House coming down. We can destroy the Statue of Liberty and take it down if we want to. We have that much power. So you're starting to get power and money married like that in Donald Trump in a way that no other president, even we, it's hard to dream of that kind of character running our country, running roughshod over our national economy and culture.
Well, that's Douglas Brinkley, professor at Rice University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Brinkley, on Studio 2.
Thank you.
I want to read a couple more comments. We have Bobby on YouTube who says, I find his practices repulsive. He, meaning Trump, is treating the U.S. public the same way he has treated contractors with no regard for their well-being. Jay says it's absolutely disgusting how he and his cronies are fleecing this country and treating our money like an endless piggy bank. The slap in the face was a hidden caveat that the IRS or Justice Department can never audit or investigate their finances. That's Bobby and Jay. And so, you know, Eric, I wanted to use another example that we can walk through, take a couple minutes and walk through this because it's closer to home. And it's specifically about the Dell company. Michael Dell and his wife pledged $6.25 billion to help the president launch Trump accounts, a tax advantage investment saving initiative for American children. But the Dell family and Dell Technologies got a really huge return on investment in multiple ways. Could you just sort of walk us through how these, the timeline of, you know, $6.25 billion pledge and then government contracts and also stock investments by the Trump family into the Dell companies and the timing of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example, and there are so many of them, it becomes hard to track them all. And even for us, and we have a team of reporters that are attempting to track them all. But in the Dell case, yes, Michael Dell promised to make this massive investment into these Trump accounts, which are a new way of saving for your children, that you put, you know, money into them. And he was going to seed some of these Trump accounts with this, you know, certain amount of foundational funds. And it was a huge coup for President Trump because he was announcing this new mechanism, which essentially it's like a 401k, but for people who don't have 401ks necessarily. When Michael Dell announced that, Trump went on to praise Michael Dell for doing that. He also spoke at an event where he said, you know, you should all go out and buy Dell computers. In early this year, President Trump's investment portfolio, which made 3,600 trades in the first 3 months of this year. So an incredible amount of buying and selling, according to these mandatory disclosure forms. Among the investments that President Trump's portfolio made was an investment of somewhere between $1 million and $5 million into Dell computers. And that investment was made. After that investment was made, then the Department of Defense recently announced the multi-billion dollar contract to use Dell to buy Microsoft software for the Department of Defense. So it's one of the biggest, it's a huge contract that Dell got. So the sequence there is Dell does something that benefits, Michael Dell does something that benefits a Trump program. Trump then, through his family stock holdings, invest in Michael Dell's company. Then the government invests in Michael Dell's company by having a multi-billion dollar Pentagon contract. So it just, again, creates these blurred lines. The Trump family asserts that the president himself and that his sons are not actually actively making investment decisions for those 3,600 trades, that this is an investment advisor that's doing this trading. But the president does know, you know, what investments are happening on his behalf.
Yeah.
I mean, now just going back for a minute, I mean, you know, the President Trump was elected, you know, as the guy who was the host of The Apprentice show. And mm-hmm. I mean, it just is. I think that, you know, we live in the markets, you know, along the East Coast and the West Coast, you know, many of your listeners. I mean, and I live in Washington, D.C., and, you know, we look at this one way. But I mean, Trump is a hero to many people around the world because of the way that he's, you know, presented himself as this savvy businessman, you know, who made himself rich. And from his perspective, he's just continuing this tradition. And I think there's a lot of Americans who look at what he's doing and look at this guy. He's super rich. He's brilliant. He's turning, you know, dirt into gold. And that's part of his whole shtick. And they celebrate him for that. And, and he feels like he's free to do it. So that's his perspective. We look at it differently, or many people look at it differently, and there's a friction over that. But there's a lot of Americans who are celebrating his pursuit of wealth, I think.
And I wonder, because he's so open about it, it doesn't seem like, you know, when you usually hear people getting bribed or corruption, it always feels like it's very sneaky and that it's behind closed doors and that there's a bag of money trading hands in a parking lot somewhere, right, in the shadows. But in this instance, does the that out in the open, in the sunlight of it, is that the thing that to you as someone who's covered things like this, that is more shocking, that maybe is allowing the American people to say, hey, he's a business guy. He's just doing what businessmen right. do.
I mean, you look at Don Jr., his son, his oldest son, who is works at an investment firm now that has invested in the drone industry. And so he has put money into drone manufacturers. And then those drone manufacturers are now getting Pentagon contracts. And the president is pushing the Pentagon to accelerate its investments in drones. And his son is an investor in a company that is benefiting from that. And again, you know, and that's all right in the SEC filings. You can see that. And so there's lots of these cases, and it is sort of startling about how forward it is. They see it. You know, I'm a businessman, Don Jr. I'm a businessman. I'm making deals. I'm not getting any special treatment. Now, whether or not he's getting special treatment, it's very hard to disaggregate that. And it's something that we attempt to do. And sometimes it looks like they may be getting special treatment, in fact.
Yeah. Well, I rarely do this, Eric, but we have a few minutes left, and there's a bunch of other examples we could go through. I'll just name a few. Mm-hmm. And you tell me if there's one that you think would be helpful for our listeners to walk through for a few minutes. There's a conflict of interest around Kazakhstani mining rights that have to do with tungsten mining. There's the case of the Al-Kayat brothers, a trio of Syrian billionaires. There is the anti-weaponization fund. There are the ballroom donors. There is the Trump family's interest in prediction market companies. Any of those you think are particularly worth spending a few minutes walking through because they highlight perhaps something we haven't seized on yet?
I mean, the predictions markets are, you know, have exploded in the last year. And the commodities futures trade, the CFTC, which is a federal agency that Trump appoints the chairman of, they have basically backed away from much of the regulation around the two major companies in that space at the same time as Trump's sons are investors in those companies. And again, it just creates, you know, just like with crypto and now with predictions markets, the Trump family sons are investing in areas exploiting effectively the regulatory policy that their dad has championed. It's something we just have not seen at a scale like this before in American history. Similarly, the Saudi government is building a real estate project in Saudi Arabia. There's another conflict where the Trump family has announced that projects in Vietnam went at the same time as Trump was squeezing Vietnam over tariffs. And then they announced the deal to do a Trump family real estate deal in Vietnam. And then the tariffs came down. There's projects in Saudi Arabia and in places across Eastern Europe. And these are countries that are seeking preferential treatment from the White House again. So it's just like everywhere you look, it really is a challenge as a reporter and as a team of reporters just to try to keep up with documenting each one of them, to learn all the facts, to pull them together into a story and present them to people so you can evaluate it on your own. And that's what we've at least been trying to do, although we're having the sprint to keep up with it all.
What do you think the ultimate impact will be on the norms for presidents in the future, because President Trump will only be president, you know, a couple more years? How do you think what he has done during the second term could shift how the presidents act in the future?
It really is hard to predict that. I mean, you know, when President Biden came in after President Trump's first term, I mean, there was a lot of criticism of Hunter Biden, who was doing paintings and selling his paintings, but that was pretty trivial compared to what we're talking about here. But it's sort of hard to predict norms. I mean, it depends upon what the future candidate is and what kind of values that future candidate, be it a Democrat or Republican, brings in. And also, I mean, you know, I think it's unlikely that there will be a constitutional change. And I think it probably would require a constitutional change, because I think anything that Congress would do would be challenged as being a violation of the executive branch, you know, prerogatives. So the norms question, it certainly raises the possibility that this is going to become a norm, and that this will be something that is part of, I mean, the United States for decades has stood for a separation between the private interest of government officials and the pursuit of profits. And it is something that the United States has championed around the world for decades, both Democrats and Republicans, through a law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And it was something that we worked for so long to try to create the separation. And you know, in Africa and in parts of Eastern Europe, and where bribes were constantly being paid in order to get a government contract. And this was something that was so important to the United States. And now I'm not saying that bribes are being paid to Trump, but just this blurring of a line between the public interest and the private interest is sort of undermined decades of effort, a bipartisan effort. And so it has undermined a norm. And as to where we go from here, it really is up to voters and up to the next president to decide.
Well, that's the final word from Eric Lipton, investigative reporter for the New York Times. You mentioned you and your team are sprinting to keep up. And of course, we wish you the best of that because sunlight is important. Eric Lipton, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you to our caller for today, as well as to everybody who wrote in with their thoughts and questions about this important topic. And of course, thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calliquet engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.